Good afternoon, and thank you all for holding. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion of today's conference. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Bill Finnefrock. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Lon. I want to welcome all of our participants. My name, as she said, is Bill Finnefrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and I'm the moderator for today's call. Let me take a moment to remind you to, you know, try and get in an area where it's quiet and secure, but your phone lines will be muted, so you don't have to worry. You shouldn't have to worry about background noise. Today's topic is ICD-10 documentation requirements, and we're pleased to introduce Dr. Joe Nichols, a recognized expert on physician coding and documentation. Dr. Nichols is a board-certified orthopedic surgeon who has been in healthcare for over 35 years. For the past 15 years, he's been full-time in healthcare IT, has been involved in product management, database design, quality metrics, and other healthcare data-related activities. He also spent 5 years as the CEO of a Medicaid third-party administrator company, and he currently co-chairs 3 subgroups for WEDI, which stands for the Work Group for Electronic Data Interchange. He's given numerous national presentations for payers and providers and received the WEDI Merit Award in 2009 and 2010. He'll give us a brief overview of some of the ICD-10 requirements, but most importantly, talk with us about the documentation requirements for ICD-10. I want to note that this series is part of our ongoing series sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy in conjunction with the National Organization of State Offices of Rural Health and the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. Today's call is the 55th in our series, which began in late 2004. And during that time, we've had over 14,800 combined participants on these bimonthly calls. As you all know, there's no charge to participate in this series, and we encourage you to refer others who might benefit from the information to sign up to receive the announcements. During the Q&A period, we ask that the callers please provide their name, city, and state before asking their question. And note that if you'd like to, in the future, email questions or topic ideas, send them to info@narhc.org and put RHCTA question in the subject line. Dr. Nichols, I'd like to turn the program over to you, and we look forward to your remarks. And at the end, we'll open it up, and the operator will give instructions for questions.
Well, thank you, Bill. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to your group here. If we're going to go through these slide by slide, but we may be going through some fairly quickly because there's a lot of material here, and we probably want to save as much time as we can for questions at the end. But you should have all of this information for review, so we'll get started here. So if you go to slide 2, it really just sets out the agenda for what we're going to try and discuss. And basically the assumption going in is that you have some basic knowledge of what ICD-10 is and how it's different. We're not going to review all of those basics again because I believe most folks have at least had the opportunity to take a look at that. We really want to focus on how will it impact your business? What's the role of physician and office practice managers? What do you need to do to prepare for this? And really focus a lot on why is clinical documentation, good coding, important? How can you identify what needs to be documented? What are some of the strategies for reducing the apparent burden on the physician? And how much can you do to make sure the documentation quality and coding is achieved and maintained over a period of time? So if we go to slide 3, this is the first slide. It just kind of illustrates some of the business impacts, and I'm sure a lot of you have already kind of looked and realized that coding, electronic health record updates, training, coding software are all things that are going to be significant business impacts moving through this transition, which I think is one of the biggest changes we've seen in many years in healthcare information. Contracting may change, case rates, carve-outs. Certainly billing will change, billing code updates, billing edits, charge masters if you have those. Benefits and coverage determinations may be very different under ICD-10. One of the things we do is go around to all the states. I think we just finished our 42nd state talking to the state Medicaids about this, and the definition of benefits and coverages are going to change substantially because we've redefined those patients. In slide 4, we just continue with that, talking about what are some of the impacts in terms of just being compliant. This is a HIPAA law. It requires that everyone be compliant with this as of October 1st, 2014, so essentially a year from now. And this is based off of date of services or date of discharge, but every payer, this isn't Medicaid, this isn't Medicare, it's every payer, every provider, every clearinghouse that is a HIPAA-covered entity must comply with this. This may have impacts beyond HIPAA to reporting, national, state, regional type of initiatives, contract requirements, accreditation. We may also see impacts on reimbursement, pay for performance, never events, readmissions, hospital-acquired conditions. Many payers are looking at who do they include in their network based off of quality measures. We may see changes in denials based off of coverage decisions. So there is a reimbursement impact, even though we don't pay directly on these codes. These codes factor into the payment and will do so a lot more in the future. And also audits are certainly increasing, RAC audits, coding audits of all kinds. And so having accurate documentation to support accurate coding is going to be even more important as we move into this next phase. If we go to slide five, I tried to summarize what's the role of the clinical and business and coding areas in a practice, and how are those change relationships changing. And trying to sum that up, the role of the clinician really is to document as accurately as possible the nature of the patient's condition and the services done to maintain or improve those conditions. The guides for coding are very explicit. They say that the code should always represent as accurately as possible what the patient's condition is. Coding for billing purposes is really not appropriate. The coding is to represent as accurately as possible what the patient's condition is. The role of the coding professional is to ensure that the coding is consistent with that documentation. And the role of the business manager is to assure that all the billing is accurately coded and supported by the documented facts. Otherwise, audits may want to recover those dollars. If we move to slide six, we're going to talk a little bit about transition. What do you need to do? What are some of the key questions you need to ask as you're moving into this transition? And hopefully you've already started this, because a year is not a lot of time to get all this pulled together. So if we go to slide seven, one of the first questions you want to ask is, what are the moving parts of your practice? What are the things that impact you that are important to your practice? And in order to do that and answer that question, you have to create an inventory of what are all the functional aspects of the practice, determine those areas that might be directly or indirectly impacted by those codes, and then begin to prioritize those areas based off of cost or volume or clinical or business importance. You may not be able to address all areas perfectly, so understanding where the key hotspots are and understanding where the impacts are will help you define where you need to prioritize effort. Slide eight, we ask the question, where are your dependencies? And in order to address that, you have to inventory all those areas where you have a dependency that may impact your ability to successfully implement ICD-10, whether it's payers, other providers you deal with, software vendors, regulatory agencies, any internal and external resources critical to your business. You want to know where those dependencies are and where they are in terms of doing the things they need to do where you have those dependencies. Slide nine, the question is, who needs to understand ICD-10? Well, you need to really identify those persons by role who may be impacted by ICD-10 or the documentation needed to support proper coding. You may not be coding, but the coding is really coming out of the documentation, and so persons who are responsible for gathering that documentation and for the coding all need to have a fairly good understanding of what this new thing is and how it's different from what we've been doing in the past. You also need to define your approach to education. Are you going to do a train-the-trainer approach, where someone within the organization is going to get well-trained on ICD-10 and then pass that knowledge on? Are you going to be looking at role-based education that says we have the right level of information with the right focus and content at the right time? I know a lot of physicians, for example, aren't really interested in coding. Their primary role is going to be in documentation, and the coders are going to need that documentation to go forward. Coders may need a different level. Business persons may need a different level of, but almost everyone is going to be impacted some way. And what is the training that's going to be provided? How will you know if this training was successful or not? Is a way to test that within your organization. On slide 10, we ask the question, what do I need to do to implement? Well, in order to do that, you have to identify specific tasks, and that's based on an analysis of the business and clinical areas that either are directly or indirectly impacted by ICD-10. Almost everything we do relates to a patient condition or service, and in that instance, almost all of those, as we generate claims or other data, is going to directly or indirectly relate to some ICD-10 code in many instances. Identification and prioritization of those areas that are critical to your business. This may be high dollar, high volume. It may be areas of high complexity or areas that are important or areas where there is a compliance requirement. Analysis of what are your key dependencies. In addition, you need to have a realistic project plan where you've taken those tasks and you organize them in such a way that timing, priority, and critical path dependencies are known so that this can actually be accomplished. Identify and assign resources, execute and measure your progress for that. Good project plan means it needs to be doable and it needs to be comprehensive to cover all the things that need to be covered. Next question you might ask is, how do I know my efforts are working? Well, in order to do that, you need to define and implement test cases that are consistent with those areas that are important, high volume, high dollar, key business or clinical importance. You need to identify what you need to measure for success. Is coding accurate? How are you going to measure that? Is coding specific? How do you measure coding specificity? To what degree is financial continuity maintained? Is what we were billing before compared to what we got paid changed? Is the denial rate changed? Is the rejection of claims changed? So there are some key things that need to be understood. One of the things that is very helpful to do, since we've never been in ICD-10 before and we've never been in, never really had any experience with that, is we need to take those things that we're familiar with today and create a scenario. We identify something that we do on a regular basis and say, all right, that's not going to change between now and October 1st, but how will that event or condition be recorded? How will it be documented? How will it be coded as we move into this new environment? And then we try and recreate that event virtually. We're not in ICD-10 yet, but we're walking through the pathway. It's kind of like doing a fire drill where, you know, we don't have an actual fire, but we've dressed people up. We do go through the steps to try and identify where are those areas we need to focus on, where are the gaps, where are the specific tasks that need to be done. Defining a variety of assumptions about those particular scenarios helps us use the same scenario and then apply sort of different things to do it. So we're trying to essentially, with a scenario through what's called a reference implementation model, walk through our current systems or processes using these scenarios with different assumptions about different payers, different variables, different types of patients, and then determine if the expected results can be achieved given the changes that we've implemented. So we've kind of done that fire drill or disaster drill, so to speak, to see whether we've left anything out. In slide 13, we talk a little bit about what are some of the key financial metrics. If you're going to be going through this change, there is a high likelihood that payment models might be impacted. We may see challenges in terms of getting claims out the door. A lot of payers may have some challenges in remediating their rules so that they pay appropriately. There is a significant chance we could see increased levels of denials and rejections if payers are not ready for this, and we certainly hope they are, but something that needs to be monitored. And in order to do that, you need to know what is your current baseline in terms of the rate of claim denials and rejections. Does this vary by individual, provider, or business area? And then across this transition period, is the rate changing, and where are the changes occurring? And then are denial appeals being successful in this new model? You might also want to look at the ratio of bill to pay. In other words, we're billing a certain amount today. We're getting paid some portion of that back. That ratio, has it changed across this period of time? Has suddenly those things that we were getting paid at a certain ratio before changed in the past? So looking at those things is important. If we move to slide 14, some other financial metrics that you may want to consider is looking at payment delays. What is your current claim lag from bill to paid? Is that changing across the transition? Is there a change with different payers or different business areas? Looking at audits, are audits increasing? Are appeals related to adverse and audit findings successful? So a lot to be watching during this transition. This is kind of a risky period in the fact that we're making a major change in how we're defining patients' conditions in data, in transactions, and these things can impact a number of different areas. And we want to have measures in place so we know what the background is and we know whether that's been a substantial change. So let's go to slide 15. Now, as we mentioned, there is a lot of new codes. We have almost 69,000 new diagnosis codes, where we have 14,000 today. And everyone looks at that and goes, that's a lot of codes. And it certainly is. But if we look historically at how we've used codes, we only use a very small percentage of the codes. This is looking at a study of 3 years of data for one of the Blues in the Midwest, and able to look at this data over 3 years and do some analysis. And if we look at that analysis, 5% of the codes account for well over 70% of the dollars paid, or 70% of the charges, I should say. So a very small percentage of the codes account for a very large percentage of what impacts our charges. When we're looking at that, we want to look at those areas of conditions that are covered by those codes and look at focusing our efforts in those areas where we see a substantial impact in terms of the numbers. And again, it's very skewed. There's a lot of codes, and certainly in ICD-10 there will still be a lot of codes that the reality is we'll never use. If we move to slide 16, again, as we mentioned, the ICD-10 codes are increasing fairly dramatically in terms of the number of codes, but there's really a reason for that, and that increase is very different in different clinical areas. So in this table, what I'm trying to illustrate is if we look at a clinical area like fractures, we see that there's a substantial increase in the number of codes, 747 codes going to 17,000 codes, so a very dramatic increase in the number of codes relevant to fractures, and we'll talk a little bit about why that occurs. Poisoning and toxic effect, number of codes have gone up substantially. Pregnancy-related conditions, they've gone up substantially. But there's a number of areas where the codes have really not changed greatly. For codes like migraine, for example, we've only added 4 codes. For bleeding disorders, we've added 4 codes. In some areas, the number of codes have actually gone down, and particularly relevant to behavioral health, today we have 78 codes for mood-related disorders or affective disorders. In ICD-10, we have 71, so we have less codes. We have half the codes relevant to hypertensive disease that we have today, end-stage renal disease, about half the codes. So in some clinical areas, the codes are minimally changed or actually have gone down some. In other areas, they've gone up substantially. Now, one of the reasons they've gone up substantially in these other areas is because we have a lot of repeating concepts. In other words, for something like a fracture, for exactly the same fracture, the same detail of the fracture, every fracture we have to say whether it's initial encounter, whether it's subsequent encounter, or sequelae. So that multiplies that times 3. We have to say if it involves a side, whether it's right or left. If it's a follow-up, we have to say whether it's normal healing, delayed healing, non-union, or malunion. So you multiply those by each and every fracture, and you see we end up with a lot of codes. Similarly, in pregnancy-related conditions now, we actually have for most codes, which trimester is it, first trimester, second trimester, or third trimester. We didn't have that before, so that multiplies those codes substantially. So one of the reasons we see such a large increase in codes is not because we have new diseases or substantially different concepts. It's really because we now are using codes that contain a lot of information in a single code, and so we end up with many multiples that only vary on a few factors. So let's go to slide 17. I want to focus a little bit of time talking about documentation. And one of the challenges we face with documentation is it really could be a lot better. I mean, anyone who's looked at clinical documentation, I've certainly looked at a lot of that, will say that we really could do a bit of a better job. You know, there were things that we were taught in medical school that we should be documenting, all of these details. And when we were medical students, we documented all of that stuff. And as we got into practice and busier, we tend not to document a lot of that stuff. But it's still just as important. And if we don't have good documentation, this is really bad for all payers, providers, and patients, because it impacts billing accuracy, it impacts quality measures, population management, risk management, healthcare analytics. Most importantly, bad documentation is not good for patient care, and it's critically important that that's the primary focus of documentation. If we move into slide 18, why is it important? Well, it supports proper payment and reduced denials. It helps assure accurate measures of quality and efficiency. What we see in ICD-10 in terms of levels of severity and risk is substantially different than in ICD-9, and that severity and risk is very important in determining the difference in outcomes and quality measures and efficiencies. It helps us address some of those issues around accountability and transparency. It provides us better information about business intelligence, about what type of conditions are we taking care of. Has that changed? Have the disease characteristics changed over the population that we're dealing with? Where is the risk associated with those populations? It helps support clinical research. A lot of clinical research is relying on this type of data with these codes to look at effectiveness, and will help us enhance communication with hospitals and others that we're involved in with health information exchanges, because it is the only national standard we have that crosses all of these enterprises that defines the patient's health state, and that's going to be critical to everything we do in terms of exchanging information in healthcare. The most important reason for documentation is it's just good care. We can't take good care of patients if we don't have good information about the nature of their conditions. One of the things, if we go to slide 19, whenever I'm presenting to physician groups, I always get this pushback that documentation is really this unnecessary administrative burden caused by ICD-10. And if we look under the covers a little bit, though, if we look at what the new concepts are in ICD-10, none of these are new or foreign to clinicians. All of these are concepts that we should be familiar with today. Nothing new has happened. It's just now we're able to capture a lot of these concepts in codes where we were unable to capture those before. The real focus on documentation is not about ICD-10 coding. It's about good patient care. And if you really look at all of those concepts today, there's very few of them that you can't say wouldn't be important in taking care of the patient. And clearly, patients deserve to have accurate and complete documentation of their conditions. For those of us who are becoming more patients than we are providers, you know, every time I see my physician, I really want to know his document. I want to know that it's correct. I'm much more interested in that at this point in time, and you know, I think we deserve that. And if you look at other industries, the value of accurate and complete documentation of data about encounters and transactions is critically important, and we should be able to document at least as well as other organizations. We wouldn't expect for a plumber, for example, to be very vague about what the problem is and what he did and give us a bill. We'd want to know what the problem was and what was done, and I think patients want the same thing. So I think a focus on good documentation is not about an ICD-10 administrative burden. It's really about what do we need to do to capture some information that is important. The bottom line is that it's also necessary for us to code accurately. If we look at coding, it really is, again, all centered about there's a patient interface. Something happens with that patient. We see them. We do a physical exam. We look at their records. We do studies on that patient. We take a history. We'll do an external record review, and we gather all that information and document an assessment of what we think is going on with that patient's condition. Without that, and without complete observation and doing all of those things that we were taught in medical school, without documenting that, we can't get to a code. But for a lot of us, coding has been, and certainly in my practice in the past, it's always been about do something quick and easy to get that bill out the door. We have our super bill. We check a box. We send it to the back office. We may have some queries back and forth. If we look at slide 22, this is just an example of an orthopedic super bill, one similar to the one that I had in practice that has all of these different codes listed there, and you'll see a section about fractures of the radius, and there's a list of codes there, fractures of the forearm. There's a list of codes there. If we look in ICD-9, there were 32 possible codes that could be on there. In theory, if it wasn't listed here, I should use the code that's most appropriate, but these are the codes I saw most frequently. In ICD-10, there's 1,731 codes for fractures of the radius and the forearm area. So now we're looking at something that would take many pages of a super bill to cover all of the codes that might be relevant to conditions that we might see. The concept of the super bill may not work well, and particularly in certain specialties, because we now simply have too many codes out there that describe very different types of conditions, and it's critical that we document those things going forward. So let's go to slide 23 and said, all right, if we're going to be documenting, what are the things that we need to document? And basically, these are things, again, that we were taught in medical school, but now they apply to how we're going to code, and we're going to try and take some of those concepts of documentation and see if we can see how they apply to certain different conditions. So basically, when we're evaluating the patient, one of the things we want to know is what type of condition is. Is it type 1 or type 2 diabetes, or what type of condition is it? When was the onset? When did it start? What was the cause? Is this related to an infectious agent, a physical agent, an internal failure, some congenital failure? We might look at things like anatomical structure. Is it proximal, distal, medial, lateral? Is it in a specific area of a specific bone or a specific area of a specific organ? So we document that, whether it's right or left. Well, you know, was it a fracture involving the right arm or the left arm? Is critically important. Severity. Is it something that's mild, moderate, severe? For certain types of condition, are there environmental factors like smoking? Is this related to a geographic location? We might look at things like the time parameters. Is this intermittent or paroxysmal? Is it recurring? Is it acute or chronic? Is it post-op, post-delivery? We might look at things like comorbidities. Is this, for example, diabetes with a neuropathic joint? Is there intracranial injury associated with a skull fracture, for example? Manifestations. Was one of the manifestations paralysis? Was one of the manifestations loss of consciousness or some other manifestation? We might be looking at things like healing level. Is it normal healing? Is the healing delayed? Is there non-union of a bone, for example, or malunion, meaning it's healed improperly? So all of these are kind of basic concepts that if we look at and look at the types of documentation we need, you know, we basically should be documenting these types of things today. So let's move on to looking at slide 27. And in slide 27, what I wanted to do is just illustrate that there are a lot of concepts in ICD-10 that recur over and over again. And this is important to know because these concepts that recur and impact many codes, we should be capturing that information if we want to get to the right code. And one of the techniques for trying to reduce the burden is capture this information up front as part of a question when the patient comes in, as part of an interview done by a non-clinician, for example, that might be done that says, look, we're going to need to record this stuff. Why don't we just capture it right up front and not have to capture that during the clinician time? Things like initial encounter impacts 13,900 codes, or whether it's a subsequent encounter, 21,000 codes, whether it's a sequelae, 11,000 codes, right versus left. If you look at all the ICD-10 codes, one-third of the codes are exactly the same except for right or left. That's the only difference, is whether it's right or left. So it's kind of important to capture that because that's going to impact well over a third of the codes. So let's take a specific condition and let's walk through and say, what are the types of concepts? And again, coding is about documenting key medical concepts. What are the types of concepts we might see in these particular types of conditions, and how might those relate to ICD-10 codes? So if we go to slide 28, we're going to take something basic like otitis media. And moving on to slide 29, the first thing we might ask is, what type of otitis media is it? Is it serous? Is it suppurative or non-suppurative? Is it tubotympanic type? Is it allergic type? Is it mucoid type? again, things that we would normally capture in terms of evaluating that patient. Moving on to slide 30, there may be a lot of other alternative terms we might use, like whether it was sanguineous, whether it was exudative, whether it was secretory, all of these things that we might capture in part of that evaluation about the type of otitis media. If we move to slide 31, we might also document things. What was it associated with? Was it associated with a spontaneous rupture? Was it associated with some infectious or external agent? And if so, what was it? Was it associated with smoking? Was it associated with some allergic or non-allergic condition? Slide 32, were there temporal factors involved? In other words, was this acute or subacute, or was it chronic? Is it recurrent? Laterality, was it left or right, or was it bilateral or unilateral? So all of these things are kind of things that we might want to capture as part of a normal evaluation of a patient with otitis media. So let's look in slide 33 at what some of the ICD-10 codes would look like and see where those concepts factor into that code. So here we are looking at a set of ICD-10 codes relevant to otitis media, and we'll see things like measles complicated by otitis media. So we're addressing that issue. What was the infectious agent? Acute serous otitis media right ear. In this case, we're saying that it was acute. It was a serous otitis media, and it involved the right ear. Or we might look at a code like H66012, acute separative otitis media with spontaneous rupture of the eardrum of the left ear, where we're capturing that it was acute, that it was separative, that there was a spontaneous rupture, and it involved the left ear. And so as we see these types of concepts repeating in these codes, it's really capturing those concepts that are important, because we really can't identify the right code if we don't get those concepts. If all we say is otitis media, we don't say which ear, we don't say what type of drainage or whether there was a rupture of the membrane, then we're not going to be able to code accurately. And knowing what those things are is helpful to know what the codes are, but more importantly, we should probably be capturing all those things today just for good patient care. So let's look at another example. Go to slide 34, and here we're looking at pulmonary disease. So we're going to be talking about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, chronic bronchitis, asthma. And again, we look at what are some of the types of concepts that we might want to capture in evaluating a patient. Caused by, was it a chemical or environmental agent? There's a lot of agents out there that, like coal miners' disease and those types of things. The pneumoconiosis is where specific chemicals, asbestosis, other sorts of things, or environmental agents may make a big difference in what caused this particular condition. Smoking. What type of smoking? Was it secondary? Was it related to a dependence or environmental smoke? Was it related to some allergic or non-allergic type of factor? In slide 36, we might ask questions about temporal factors. Was it acute, chronic, intermittent? Was it persistent? Severity, things like asthma. We now capture in asthma whether it was mild or moderate or severe, whereas we weren't capturing those things in ICD-9. They're important in patient care, but they're now also needed in terms of coding properly. Moving to slide 37, bronchitis, looking specifically at bronchitis, we would want to capture, is it simple bronchitis? Is it mucopurulent? Is there, it is associated with tracheitis or tracheobronchitis? In slide 38, we're looking specifically at things like emphysema. We want to capture what type. Is it unilateral pulmonary emphysema, which can be described as a number of alternative terms below it? Is it panlobar emphysema? Is it centralobular emphysema? Or is it some other form of emphysema noted in 39, bullous emphysema, emphysematous bleb? If we move to slide 40, for other types of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, we might want to record things like, was there an acute lower respiratory infection? And if so, what was the infectious agent? Was there exacerbation of the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease? What are some of the other forms that we were looking at? In slide 41, specifically around asthma, we may want to record things like what specific type of asthma was it? Was it associated with wheezing? Is it exercise-induced bronchospasm? Is there cough variant type asthma? Is it atopic type asthma? in slide 42, again, talking about some of the alternatives that might be used to describe asthma. Slide 43, again, just some of the other alternative terms that might be used in terms of asthma, whether it's idiosyncratic, whether it's non-allergic. So all of these are concepts that may or may not be relevant to asthma, but again, if relevant, we want to see them documented. Similarly, in slide 44, was it uncomplicated? Was it associated with acute exacerbation? Was it associated with status asthmaticus? Where appropriate, those certainly should be documented. So let's look at some of the codes that are associated with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, bronchitis, and asthma, and see where those concepts come in. So here is a list of example codes related to those chronic pulmonary diseases, and we'll see J418, mixed simple and mucopurulent type chronic bronchitis, J432, central lobular emphysema, J41, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease with acute exacerbation, for asthma, severe persistent asthma with status asthmaticus. So those concepts that we're capturing all factor into which code might be selected. Now let's look at slide 46. So one of the things we want to be looking closely at is, are we using non-specific codes? There's going to be a lot of emphasis on using codes that are specific to the particular condition. And it's important that for proper coding, for proper data, to make sure that we've got the documentation needed to support that code going forward, that we have as specific codes as we can get. Now, there are times when we can't get that specific, but wherever possible, we should. So the challenge really is what do we mean by specific codes? So if we go to slide 47, you'll see some folks, we don't use unspecified codes, but it's hard to describe what do we mean by that. So what I've done here is tried to put together a definition of what we consider a poorly specified coding. And this really is defined as coding that does not fully define important parameters of the patient condition that could otherwise be defined given the information available to the observer and the coder. So if it's an important condition, a parameter of the patient condition, and given that the observer has access to the information, the coder, we should code to the greatest level of specificity known. Now, sometimes you just don't know that. So in slide 48, as we mentioned, sometimes unspecified really makes sense. If the patient is early in the course of evaluation, a patient comes in and presents and says they've got abdominal pain, they really don't have any other symptoms, they can't define it a whole lot better, they can't even describe the location a lot better, you don't know exactly what's going on there, but as part of the initial evaluation, start ordering the appropriate tests and further evaluation. So early on, maybe all we know is that it's abdominal pain. If it's the third or fourth or the tenth visit and the diagnosis is still abdominal pain, then we have to really wonder, are we doing anything at that point in time? The diagnosis may change as we go over time, as we gather more information. As we do, the coding should become more specific, relevant to those changes. So the claim, again, coming from that provider who is not directly related to the patient's condition may not be at a level of specificity. There may be certain providers who really don't have that information or who don't even do diagnosis, but they still have to submit a code. In that case, non-specified codes may make a lot of sense. And there are some types of coding that really are not appropriate for generalists. They may be more appropriate for specialists. A lot of generalists may not know that a patient with a acute Maisonneuve fracture with a open Gustilo class 3, they may not know all of those details, but the specialist taking care of the patient should. So the clinician who's seeing that as a generalist may code to a lower level of detail describing an open fracture of the tibia, whereas the specialist might code to a much greater level of detail. So the use of specificity varies. The key is that we should always be coding to the level that's most specific given the knowledge of the patient and the level of the provider at that period of time. If we go to slide 5, there are a lot of codes that are out there right now in ICD-10 that really we probably should never use or very rarely if ever. So anytime we have sufficient information to be more accurate, we shouldn't be using anything unspecified. There are some basic concepts that we should essentially never use unspecified. So if you look at all of the codes relating to laterality, you'll find ICD-9 codes that say right side, left side, or site unspecified. Well, if we're going to treat a patient, we ought to know what side it is. We ought to know whether it's right or left. We ought to know whether it's bilateral or unilateral. And really, there's no reason to use an unspecified site. Certain anatomical locations, if we're going to treat a patient, we ought to know something vague. We should know something more than something vague like it's the right upper extremity. We ought to know where. We ought to be able to define that. We ought to know, if we're treating OB patients, which trimester it is, what type of diabetes it is. If there's complications or comorbidities, we ought to be able to know and document those things. And certainly severity levels, acute or chronic. If you're treating a patient for respiratory failure, we should never be using a code saying unspecified respiratory failure. We can't really treat the patient if we don't know whether it's acute or chronic or other key parameters. So the idea is that if we're going to treat that patient, there's a certain level of detail that we should know, and the code should really reflect that. There are sometimes when the care is, in order to care for a patient, we need to have a lot of detail. And again, if the specialty level is such that you're a specialist, you ought to be able to define to a much greater level of detail, because that's going to be important in the data and documentation. So let's go to slide 50. The bottom line about these codes is they really represent patient data about healthcare, and that patient data is used for a lot of purposes, not only billing. It's used for analysis. It's used for policy setting. It's used for a whole variety of purposes in terms of trending and tracking and reporting. The bottom line is good patient data is important to good patient care. We really can't provide good care for patients if we really don't understand what's going on with the data about that patient care. And to get good patient data requires three things. It just doesn't happen. It requires three things. It requires complete observation of all the objective and subjective facts relevant to that patient's condition. It involves going back to what we were taught in medical school. When we see that patient with these conditions, here are the things that we should be observing and recording. Secondly, it requires documenting those observations. If we've looked in that patient's ear and they've got a perforated membrane and it's exudative and it's the right ear, we ought to be documenting that. The third is that given that documentation, it's coded properly. We pick the codes that represent as accurately as possible what's documented. So those three things, observation, documentation, and coding, are all critical, or else our health data is really very unreliable moving forward. So moving to slide 51, getting to good quality data is something that's an ongoing effort. It requires that, again, we have proper assessment, complete documentation, accurate coding, but we also need to constantly measure and provide feedback. Are we coding in a very specified way? Is it accurate? We need to be measuring that so we can constantly feedback to clinicians and to coders to say, here's some areas where we could potentially have some improvement. Now, moving forward, let's move to slide 52. We are moving into a very different environment under accountable care and under all the other things that are happening right now. And the bottom line is that we spend more than anywhere else in the world, and our ability to continue to spend at that level in terms of healthcare is definitely being challenged by a number of financial issues. So the whole idea of value-based or accountable care or any of the other things that are out there right now are saying we need to do something to make sure that the services that we're providing are good, that they're effective, and that we can afford them. And so that's changing the way we're looking at healthcare data, we're looking at transactions, we're looking at claims. So ICD-10 provides us an ability to look at severity and risk to a much greater level. It allows us to look at varying levels of complexity. Today, if you have an amputation of the finger, you don't know which finger it is. Under ICD-10, it tells you which finger, which level, which approach. If you look at a code for a repair of an artery, today it simply says repair of the artery. Under ICD-10, it tells you which specific artery was repaired. So certainly these measure different things in terms of levels of complexity. Severity and risk, so that we're comparing things that represents the actual condition in a much better way. better claim information can also help support more automated processing to hopefully lead to more rapid reimbursement, given that we have more data within that code that will help address that processing. There's opportunities to risk audit, to reduce audit risk exposure by making sure that the documentation and the coding are lined up appropriately. Better business intelligence, and certainly much better measures of quality and efficiency. None of this happens passively. We have to build that into how we use and leverage these codes going forward, but the codes do present some opportunities to get a lot better data, not only to process and manage care, but to also to understand and do analysis on the type of care. So just to summarize things, ICD-10 will certainly have a substantial impact on how we're going to define the patient condition for a wide variety of purposes. It isn't all about claims. It's about a lot of other uses for the data. It will certainly change how we do business, and there are a lot of looks at how we're going to pay differently in an environment that looks at not only what was done, but why. A lot of proposed new changes that are going to be using these codes in a way that they haven't been used in the past. The requirements for good documentation have really not changed. We should have always been documenting what's important in patient care. And some, if you really look at what's needed under ICD-10, almost everything there is something that is important in patient care if it applies to that patient. ICD-10 codes can certainly support much better definition of the key parameters of some of those conditions. In slide 54, clearly, complete and accurate documentation of important clinical concepts of the patient condition is a requirement for good patient care. It's also necessary for us to code accurately, but most importantly, it is a requirement for good patient care. Better data translates into better understanding of efficiency, effectiveness, and quality, and changes in payment models. We'll leverage these as we kind of move forward. All in all, ICD-10 is a big change. It's a very important change in terms of healthcare data. It will impact almost everyone in healthcare. And the bottom line is that good documentation will hopefully get us to better coding, and we should be able to do this without a substantial change in that documentation, assuming that we're documenting well today. So let me just stop there and ask if we have any questions to address.
Elon, you want to give the instructions for folks who want to ask questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your name, and please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1.
While we're waiting, you talked about the issue of the non-specific codes, and I think this has been an area where there's been some significant discussion in the provider community, and maybe you don't have any perspective, but is it largely going to be determined by the payer as to how specific they would require the coding to be with respect to whether or not they will pay the claim or send it back for additional documentation?
Right. Well, certainly the payer determines what they're going to do with that claim from a payment perspective. In terms of what's required from coding, that is not relevant to the payer. The level of specificity is defined in the guidelines and in the standard. And regardless of payer, the rules are, and audits will be based on the fact, is did we code as accurately as possible what the patient's condition is. Payers should be using that information, and how they use that is really up to them. But from a provider perspective, we should always be coding to the greatest levels of specificity possible.
And that's really not changed from ICD-9 to ICD-10, correct?
Absolutely not. That's always been the case. We haven't been doing a great job with that in many instances, but that's always been the case. And a lot of payers now are saying we're going to get a lot tighter on that. Now that we have that ability to be more specific, we're actually going to not accept codes like unspecified side or unspecified respiratory failure.
Right, and I've heard the same thing, and it makes sense that they would do that. I mean, otherwise, why go to ICD-10 if they're going to continue to allow claims to come in using unspecified? We're not getting all the more robust data that we would hope, and yet we're going through an awful lot of expense to really not improve the data that we have.
Exactly.
So, operator, do we have any calls lined up or questions,
I do. Our first question today is from Christina Hamilton.
Go ahead, Christina.
Hi, I just had a question. These ICD-10 diagnosis codes are now going to require laterality, so do we still need to use the LTRT modifiers on the CPT codes?
Christina, where are you from?
Family and Internal Medicine, Lebanon, Kentucky.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. We get that all the time. The modifiers on the service codes are still required. They don't have anything to do with ICD-10 because you may have conditions where you have laterality, but the service you do is to a specific site. And so the laterality on the service says what side you did that procedure on. The laterality on the code says what side the condition was. They may seem like minor things, but sometimes you can have a condition that is on one side or the other, and this is talking about a specific side. So, yes, they still are required on the CPT codes.
Okay. Good. Next question.
Our next question is from Karen Jones.
Karen, tell us where you're from.
Hey, guys. We're from Marble Falls, Texas, with the Scott & White Healthcare Organization.
Great.
I have a question about the well woman exams, our well child, all the V codes that we use currently. How does ICD-10 handle that, and at what level of specificity are we getting on those?
Yeah, good question. So the V codes that we're using for like EPS, DT, and other types of codes are codes that are really, they're called diagnosis codes. They really are more about encounters. Those codes will be available in ICD-10, and many of those codes are almost one-to-one in ICD-10. Often in ICD-10, you'll see a Z code used. Now, you have to be careful because a lot of the V codes translate to many other types of codes, but in general, you're going to see a very similar thing in ICD-10 for those types of codes.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. And our next question is from Amy.
Amy, where are you from?
Bay City, Michigan.
Great. What's your question?
My question is, how does the ICD-10 pertain to the MAs that work in the floor in the offices?
I had a little bit hard. Maybe you heard it, Dr. Nichols. Could you repeat your question again?
Yeah. How does the ICD-10 pertain to the medical assistants that work the floors in the offices? Because it seems like it's more for the billing.
Right. So if we're looking at putting out the codes, it's kind of a team effort to some degree. We're capturing information through a variety of sources. The bottom line is the clinician or whoever is the provider of record is responsible for recording at the accuracy level that they can what the patient's condition is, and it's up to the front office to determine which code or the billing office to determine which code should be used for that. So the MAs, for example, may play some role in pulling that information together, but ultimately whoever is the responsible treating provider is responsible for the documentation and ultimately the coding done by the billing office.
I think that question, Dr. Nichols, back early on in your slides, you talked about doing kind of an overall practice assessment or evaluation of who's going to need those codes or who's going to need that information.
Right.
And isn't that an area where this would kind of be teased out of who either is drawing information from the medical record or supplementing information? Obviously, the providers should be putting the information into the medical record, but one of the things that I've talked to folks about is, even in their current environment, is looking at your medical records and trying to code those medical records at an ICD-10 level to determine what information is missing from your documentation that will be necessary a year from now, so you can begin talking to your providers about, we've gotten a little bit lazy here. In the future, we've gotten away with this, but in the future, we're going to need X, Y, and Z, and you're not consistently putting that into the medical record.
Right, and that's a great point, Bill. Each practice is going to be different. Each specialty is going to be different. You do need to look at the codes that are relevant to you and go look at those codes and see what types of concepts are going to need to be captured. And then there may be a variety of persons in the office who may have different roles. For example, in my practice, I had someone who actually did interviews with these patients to capture a lot of this information up front so that when I saw the patient, I had a lot of this information in front of me. And so some of that was, here is some new information that we may want to capture up front because we're always going to need this in coding going forward. But understanding what the role of various folks are determines what level of understanding they need of this. And then, as you mentioned, we need to make sure that if we are not capturing this information today and we know what information we need to capture for things like otitis or for pulmonary problems or headaches, that we create prompts or assists or we educate around those types of things, saying, you know, we really needed to say whether it was acute or chronic, so we need you to capture that.
Okay. Elon, do we have other questions?
And one moment, please, for the next question. Our next question is...
We lost somebody, or I did anyway.
I apologize. Our next question is from Missy.
Missy, go ahead. Tell us where you're from.
Hi, my name is Missy. I'm from Essexville, Michigan.
Okay. What's your question?
My question is, when we are an off-site billing service relying on the MAs and PAs to document the proper information for us to code and bill out the claim, doesn't that start in the beginning when the patient enters the office and gives them their chief complaint and so forth?
Yeah, exactly. And that goes back to the slide I talked about. There's three things that we need to make sure that we get at the right data. First, they got to do the evaluation and observe and capture the things they need to do. Second, it needs to be documented, and only then can you do the coding. So if you're doing coding and you're removed from that, you're really very dependent on the folks that are doing those observations and capturing that information in order to get the right code. You can't make that stuff up. The only other option you have is to go back and query the source and say, I need this information. Which side was it? Or was it acute or chronic? You know, those types of queries are going to have to occur because you're going to have to pick a code, and you don't want to make that up.
And with that said, sir, again, that would start when the patient is in the office. Being that we're off-site, it would require the coding, the biller, rather, to request office notes in order to properly process that claim, correct?
Correct. Either that or you're going to end up using a very unspecified code, which is clearly not what we want to see happen, and secondly, the payer may not accept it. So the bottom line is we've got to get people lined up to get better documentation so you can do your job better.
And I think that that's going to be true whether it's an off-site billing company or whether it's somebody in an office. I mean, it all is what's going to be in that medical record, what's going to be in that chart that someone then is going to look and convert that into proper coding. I had a conversation recently with a doctor, and I said, how are you doing in terms of, you know, ICD-10 preparation? He said, I'm not worried about it. I'll just use a crosswalk. Mm-hmm. And can you talk to that a little bit, that this notion that somehow there's a magical computer program that's going to allow the practice to automatically convert an ICD-9 to an ICD-10 code, that just doesn't exist?
Right. No, and that's a great point, Bill, because a lot of folks have said, oh, we'll do something simple. I mean, we all want to believe in magic. We want to be able to, we can do something, and then just suddenly the solution will be there. But it simply isn't the case. We're talking about a many-to-many relationship between many ICD-9 codes, many ICD-10 codes, where they're less than 5% of the codes will map accurately. If you look at all of the codes to see which ones you can map from one code to the next, would I provide the same information that I intended? Less than 5% of the codes will do that accurately. All the rest of the codes, we're either going to assume something that may not be true, or we're going to lose some substantial information in that crosswalk that we didn't want to lose as part of a crosswalking. So I virtually never talk to providers about crosswalking because providers should never crosswalk. You should be coding and the guidelines and the requirements are is that you code as accurately as possible what that patient's condition is. You don't code for what your old code crosswalk to a new code, because it could crosswalk to 1,000 codes or 2,000 codes, and you've got to have the code that represents accurately what the patient's condition is. So I strongly recommend that no one consider using crosswalks for getting to their codes. It causes huge issues moving forward.
Ilan, we have other questions?
I am showing no further questions at this time, sir.
Okay. I think we're right up on our 3 o'clock time. Dr. Nichols, did you have any last closing comments you wanted to make?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and some great questions, and hopefully this has been some help.
I got to tell you, I've done a lot of ICD-10 meetings and conference calls and programs, and I thought this was very helpful, very educational. I'm neither a clinician nor a coder, but I found it very educational, informative, and I hope that those who are listening did as well. And it was exactly what I think we need to see, some more of this level of detail and an opportunity for folks to have these conversations. Although we are, as you noted at the outset, a year out, that's really not a whole lot of time. And there's a lot of work and a lot of education that needs to occur to make this go as smoothly and efficiently as possible. So thank you.
I'd also like to
thank everyone else for participating. I want to thank the folks from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for making Dr. Nichols available. It was extremely beneficial, I think, and without their assistance on this, this would not have happened. In the future, I want to encourage all of you who may be interested to register. If you know others who would benefit from this technical assistance series, we welcome their participation. I do want to reiterate, today's call was recorded, and a transcript of the call and a recording will be available. I don't know how quickly we will have that up and posted. It will be available on the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy website. Just so you know, that web address is www.hrsa.gov/ Rural Health, that's one word, RURALHELTH, /policy/confcall, CONFCALL, /INDEX.HTML. If you didn't get that or you need a link, just send me an email at info@narhc.org, and I will provide that to you. Again, thank you, Dr. Nichols, for a great presentation, information, and we will get you information about our next Rural Health Clinic Technical Assistance call, which will be sometime either late October, early November. Thanks, everyone, for participating, and we'll talk to you the next time.
Thank you.
And this does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.